Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 9th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Mika Laitinen, author of Viking Age Brew, The Craft of Brewing Sati Farmhouse Ale, gives us tips on harvesting and maintaining kvik and other farmhouse yeasts. He also gives us tips on how to pronounce it. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. And Steve Wilkes reminded me this past week that we produced a series of videos for supporters a few years ago. And if you sign up as a Patreon supporter, you'll get links to those videos in an email. So you'll get to see Steve prepare recipes like easy seafood au gratin with spinach, burnt ends from a smoked chuck roast. That one also includes a recipe for homemade barbecue sauce, cabbage rolls with homemade sauerkraut, and roasted duck with sauce made from homebrew wort and cherry preserves. Mmm! I'd forgotten about those, truthfully. So the other day I watched the seafood au gratin video and used it as an inspiration to make creamed spinach with crab meat and cheddar cheese for my family. Remarkably easy. So go to patreon.com/basicbrewing to get set up. Many thanks for your support. Speaking of supporters, our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast have something fun for Kvike fans coming this month. Jessica at Imperial says, this Friday, you should start seeing A37 Pog in your local homebrew stores. Here's what Imperial says about Pog. After years of surviving in cold climates, this Kvike yeast is ready for the tropical lifestyle. When used at high temperatures, Pog produces an extreme amount of tropical fruit aromas, including pineapple and guava. At the lower end of the range, more delicate citrus, peach, and kiwi aromas are noticeable. Mmm! The beer-style options are expansive for this yeast. Use it in a hazy slash juicy IPA to complement the hops, or use it in a sour-fruited beer to maximize the extreme aromatics. Imperial says, Pog likes to work fast at high fermentation temperatures. It's also strongly flocculant, which makes it great for fast turnaround. So, you know, with a recommended temperature range of 85 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, A37 Pog is perfect for summer brewing, you know, out on the porch. You know we love Imperial. At 200 billion cells, they've got the highest pitch rate of any liquid yeast producer. My stir plate is dusty because they don't make starters anymore for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. Check out what they've got at imperialyeast.com and ask your local homebrew store for Imperial Organic Yeast. Yesterday, my wife Susan helped me bottle my attempt to brew the Black is Beautiful Imperial Stout recipe that I got from the American Homebrewers Association website. The original beer is brewed at Weathered Souls Brewing in San Antonio, Texas, and is the creation of brewer Marcus Baskerville. Past Home Brewer of the Year Annie Johnson converted the recipe to the 5-gallon scale for the AHA site. They say hundreds of breweries around the world are brewing the beer. Organizers say they're hoping to raise awareness for injustices people of color face daily. You'll be seeing this beer in breweries before long. In looking at social media, I see breweries and homebrewers that I follow brewing it. It is a delicious beer with flaked oats, chocolate malt, flaked barley, roasted barley, chocolate rye, and more in the grain bill. And Marcus calls for CTZ hops for bittering with lots of cascade near the end of the boil. So, like I say, it tasted really good going into the bottle, and I can't wait for it to bottle conditioned. I brewed that big, beautiful beer on my electric brew-in-a-bag system from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa, and I hit the numbers exactly. I'm bragging because, you know, because I can. The original gravity of that beer is 1081, so it's a big beer. And the final gravity, it was 1016 for an ABV of 8.7%. Now, there's a lot of grain in this recipe, and I'm doing brew in a bag, so I started the mash with a gallon of water more than I usually do, 9 instead of 8 gallons. And after I collected my wort, I boiled for 90 minutes instead of the 60 minutes called for in the recipe, but I still added the hops at the prescribed times. With the Warthog controller from HighGravityBrew.com, I was able to maintain a rock-solid mash temperature of 154 degrees Fahrenheit for a little over an hour. Then, once I collected my wort, I was able to use the boil mode of the Warthog system to precisely dial in the boil strength. And I just love that I can just dial it in. Doesn't matter if the wind's blowing like crazy, my boil isn't going to vary. I've had listeners and viewers ask me recently about, other sort of all-in-one brewing systems. And, honestly, I just like the way mine works better. My 240-volt brew-in-a-bag setup lets me brew the way I like. I can get in there and stir the mash and get hands-on. But HighGravityBrew.com has a wide selection of electric systems for your brewing style. So even from other manufacturers, from 5 gallons to 2 barrels, HighGravityBrew.com will help you take the pain out of propane. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric gear purchase. So check it all out at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. Okay, it's great to have Mika back on the show. If you haven't gotten Viking Age Brew, the book, you need to. And you can check out Mika's blog, brewingnordic.com, for the article on harvesting yeast or harvesting kvike that is the basis of our chat today. Mika Laitinen, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I can't believe it. This happens all the time. It's a couple of months shy of a year since the last time we talked, which to me is crazy. It doesn't seem that long.
Yeah, but a lot has happened during that year, and I have had a lot of new yeasts and test a lot of new yeast techniques, and I have learned a lot and written a lot of yeast handling instructions.
Excellent. Yeah, that's what we're here to talk about. Your blog is called Brewing Nordic. If listeners want to just search for Brewing Nordic, it shows up, at least on my search engine, it shows up right at the top of the list. And you've written an article on handling kvike specifically, on harvesting and reusing and maintaining kvike yeast. That's what we want to talk about today.
Yes, and actually it also considers other farmhouse yeast from the Baltic countries. Mm-hmm. But my best experience is from Norwegian kvike.
So these are techniques that could be applied to other yeasts from other areas.
Yes, partly. The drying of yeast applies mostly to kvike, but many other techniques are good for other farmhouse yeasts too.
So are these yeasts, these farmhouse yeasts, are they more tolerant of being handled badly? I mean, are they more forgiving? it seems like to me that, if you want to reuse, typical, sort of lab yeasts, the people are pretty strict with their standards of sanitization and things like that. Are these farmhouse yeasts, are they more tolerant of people like me who may not be as strict?
Yes, in a way they are, because they have been handled with the traditional techniques, which they don't rely on science, they rely on methods that work in very rough techniques without any laboratory methods. These yeasts are very, very hardy and vital.
And maybe that's what gives them the character that they have.
Yes, I think so too.
So let's start off. You talk first about what beer is the best to harvest from. Are there certain beers that aren't good for reusing the yeast from?
Well, I often brew sahti without any hops, but I think it is best to harvest from beers which contain at least some hops, something like 10 IBUs.
Hmm.
It's better for fighting the lactic bacteria.
So the antiseptic then, properties of the hops kind of suppress some of those unwanted organisms in there.
Yes, I believe that makes a big difference. All the farmers, brewers who maintain the traditional yeast, they normally use hops.
And there are a lot of techniques for harvesting these, and there's a lot of, you know, both where you harvest it from and when you harvest it. So in general, I mean, it seems like to me that you could make some decisions that could change the outcome of the harvesting either positively or negatively.
Yes, usually these farmhouse yeasts are mixtures of several yeast strains, and if you harvest the yeast differently, then you can change the balance of the mixture, or even introduce some new yeast or new bacteria.
Hmm. So does it help to kind of know your yeast or know where it comes from and the techniques that it has been handled with, you know, over the
yes.
generations?
Yes, absolutely. It is best to go to the site called Farmhouse Yeast Registry, maintained by Lars Marius Karshol in Norway. And this site has more than 60 farmhouse yeasts listed, and it contains some really useful information about the original way of using this yeast, like, for example, fermentation temperature. Is it is the yeast harvested from top or bottom, and does it originally contain bacteria, and when the farmhouse brewer usually harvests the yeast?
But I guess if you find yourself with a sample of this yeast and you follow your own techniques in your own home brewery, you may wind up with a beer that's different from the original, but it still might be good.
Yes, especially if you just use it for few generations. But if you harvest and use it for regularly, something like 5 or 10 times, then it can really change into a different yeast.
Hmm.
That can be either good or bad.
Yeah.
It's difficult to predict what is going to happen.
So you might want to stick with what works.
Yeah, that's the first thing to try to mimic the original techniques.
So the one of the first questions is physically where to harvest the yeast from. I mean, during active fermentation, some yeast strains, you know, there's a tremendous amount of yeast in the Kreuzen, you know, up on the top of the beer as it's fermenting. You know, other strains may not have that, but you always have the option after fermentation to harvest from the bottom. So how do you make the decision of whether to harvest from the top or from the bottom?
Well, usually in the yeasts which are harvested from the top, they rise to the top very firmly, and you can really see that there's a good amount of yeast on the top, and then it is pretty certain that the original owner also harvests from the top.
Hmm. So you can tell just by looking at the fermentation, if there's a big, healthy bunch of yeast on the top, that may be the way to go.
Yes. Usually when it's the yeast rises highly on the top, then it's the best way is to harvest from the top.
Now, if you did harvest a yeast from the top that was generally harvested from the bottom, what would the detrimental effects be? How would you, you know, would that negatively affect the following generations of the yeast?
I think that for the next beer, it doesn't mean much, but then with the several generations, it can lead to different kind of yeast. For example, the top harvested yeasts usually lead to less fermented beer and kind of sweeter beer than the bottom harvested yeasts.
And why is that?
Because the farmhouse brewers usually harvest very early, and when you harvest very early the yeast, then you kind of favor those yeasts that rise to the top even before end of the fermentation. So you can end up with a yeast that rise to the top even before the beer is completely finished.
So when should you, if you decide to top crop your yeast, collect the yeast from the top of the beer as it's fermenting, when is the best time to collect that yeast?
That depends a lot on the beer, but usually the farmhouse brewers harvest from something like 20 hours after pitching to something like 48 hours. So pretty soon, something like 1 to 2 days after pitching the yeast.
So when it's active and really going at it.
Yes, and it is better to wait that the beer has gone at least halfway of fermentation.
Now, I mean, you said that a lot of these farmhouse yeast strains, let's say they're a collection, they're kind of a community of different yeasts and other organisms. So depending on the timing, you could be catching different sort of bugs when you're scooping off the top.
Yeah, it is possible that when you have a mixed culture of yeast strains and you change the harvesting method, then you favor different kind of mixture.
Mm-hmm. And so again, the research might be the best way to go to figure out the historical practices.
Yes, and it is also good to, when you continually harvest your yeast, and it is good to have a stock of several yeast from several batches, so you can kind of monitor the evolution of the yeast, and that really helps to follow where the yeast is going.
Hmm. And also, if one batch accidentally gets contaminated, you have a backup.
Yeah, that is really useful, and that is what the farmers brewers are doing.
Hmm. Now, if you decide to harvest off the bottom of the fermentation vessel, is that always done post fermentation?
I think so. I'm not absolutely sure, but I think most of these farmers brewers, they just wait for the yeast to drop and then rack or scoop the beer off the yeast and then harvest that. Yeah, and these farmer's yeast usually flocculate very fast and they begin to drop very, very early in the fermentation.
Hmm. And the tools that we're using, we haven't talked about the tools, but is it just as simple as a sanitized spoon or a scoop and maybe a bowl or a container that you can seal?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm doing and what the farmhouse brewers are doing.
And it seems like to me that when you're harvesting off the bottom, it would depend on your recipe as far as, you know, how much trub that you're going to get, you know, proteins and hop debris and things like that, as opposed to actual yeast content. Does that figure into the equation?
Yeah, especially if it's very hoppy beer, there can be a lot of trub with the yeast and that. Then you're going to perhaps harvest more yeast and use more next time because there's also a lot of protein and hop trub among the yeast.
And is there an advantage to washing the yeast then? If you have a beer with a lot of hop debris and a lot of protein, is there an advantage to washing the yeast?
I think that is kind of a difficult question. I'm not sure if anybody has tested that. Because when you wash the yeast, you store the yeast with the water and not the beer, which is acidic and alcoholic and kind of preservative. And it might be so that when you wash the yeast, you get more pure yeast, but you also end up with yeast which doesn't store so long. I haven't tested this, but I suspect that there might be something important going on with the yeast washing technique.
You're sort of taking the yeast out of its natural environment.
Yes, and I think that is also different what the farmers brewers are doing. They don't usually wash the yeast. They just harvest what's on the bottom or top.
And it seems like to me, I've tried washing yeast in the past, but it seems like to me that that's yet another step that you could accidentally introduce other organisms into the mix, you know, if you're not super careful with the way, you know, that you do it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that if the slurry is not super hoppy or full of trub, then it's not worth washing the yeast.
Is there a guideline as to how much yeast to use for the next pitch? Or in these, you know, Kvike strains, in these farmhouse strains, is that less important?
It depends on the strain. Well, Norwegian farmhouse brewers, they usually use the same amount of yeast every time, and usually the amount is very little yeast, something like 1/10 from the normal brewer's yeast pitching rate.
1/10. So,
yes, it is crazy. But the thing is that it doesn't work with all the quakes. It works for the most quakes, but some quakes need more yeast, and that is kind of difficult to know before you start testing.
Again, check the history.
Yeah, and anyway, there's no really big harm to use something like a half of the normal pitching brewer's yeast pitching rate. It gives some lot of flavor, and it doesn't harm the beer to pitch a little more to be certain.
So could you get, I mean, it seems like to me, I've read online where people say, you know, under-pitching certain Kvike strains can give you a lot more of the sort of tropical fruit flavors, or bring out, you know, more of these, you know, kind of interesting flavors. So if you over-pitch, are you risking kind of having a more sort of bland beer than you anticipated?
Yes, exactly. If you pitch more, you get less fermentation flavors. And if you want a malty beer, you can use it for your advantage. You can just pitch more yeast, and you get a more restrained fruitiness and more malt-forward beer. But if you really want this quake type of tropical fruit flavor, then you need to pitch less than what brewers are normally pitching. Hmm.
Now let's talk about, now that we've harvested our yeast, let's talk about where we keep it and how we keep it. Can you just take your scoop and put it into a plastic sealable container and stick it in the fridge and be okay?
Yeah, that works, and that's what many farmers brewers are doing.
I think you said in the article that you might want to keep the lid loose for the first couple of days to make sure that there's, you know, the fermentation has, you know, completed, and there's, you know, not any pressure going to build up in your container.
Yeah, some farmhouse brewers have had exploded mason jars in a cellar.
Oh, that's no fun.
Yeah.
We're all familiar with exploding container stories, and especially glass ones are not fun.
Yeah, it's kind of really final warning.
Yeah.
of bad techniques.
So how long will yeast keep in that condition if you just scoop it up, stick it in a container, and put it in the fridge? How long can it stay good?
Well, the normal farmer's rule is that it will keep around half a year in good condition.
Mm.
But it can keep alive for a year or two. But then if you keep it for a year, then you really need to build a good starter to see that it starts to get going and it's healthy.
Mm-hmm. And you might be changing the characteristics of the fermentation. I mean, some yeast may survive, or yeast strains in there in that mixed culture may survive better than others.
Yes, exactly. That can happen.
But with these Kvike strains, and first of all, is it Kvike or Kvake? That seems to be the people talk about that more than anything else, it seems like.
It's more like Kvike. So it's like a between Kvake or Kvike. So it's very delicate.
So it's a little of both.
Yeah, like Kvake.
It's almost, I think it's called, is it a diphthong? It's kind of a combination of the two.
Yeah, but the word is so unusual that the people will always recognize even very different pronunciations.
Ah, so you won't accidentally say something rude if you mispronounce Kvike.
Yeah, at least that's what I think. I'm not a Norwegian.
But with this strain, you can also dry it, and it will survive really well.
Yes, that is really surprising. But it tells a lot about history of beer in the past. When farmers, brewers didn't brew so often, they didn't have option to store the slurry, so they dried their yeast, and it can store good for years or even decades.
Wow. Wow. And we've seen pictures of these wooden devices, these carved wooden devices that people use to, get, I guess, put the slurry on and, you know, hang it up to dry in the barn or something.
Yeah, and the bird on those, and they don't, farmers, brewers, they didn't in the past care. They just scrape off all the dirt from the wooden yeast logs and yeast rings and just straight to brew. It is really, really incredible, hard to believe.
So if we, not necessarily wanting the bird poop on our yeast, but what's the best practice for us to, if we want to take a slurry from, and can you dry the top cropping as well as the slurry from the bottom?
Yes, you can dry both. It is best to have thick slurry, so you don't have to wait so much. You get faster drying. But either way, it works.
And is it just as simple as letting it sit out at room temperature, or do you have to add some other conditions?
Room temperature can also work, but usually people try to find slightly warmer temperatures to speed up the drying. I usually spread the quark on a baking paper and then put that paper on the top of my wood-fired oven, which is not very hot. It's more like 90 Fahrenheit, something like a bit over 30 degrees of Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a really good temperature for drying quark. And some people have used just the kitchen ovens with a really low temperature, something like 90 Fahrenheit or a bit more, and with perhaps with the door slightly open.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have also used food dehydrators, but some dehydrators go to higher temperatures, something like 120 Fahrenheit, and that begins to be a bit dangerous for the yeast.
And it would seem to me that, I mean, if you're using especially a food dehydrator, part of how that works is to recirculate air around in the dehydrator. And, you know, my instinct would be to keep as much air and, you know, airborne debris and dust and, you know, dog hair and whatever away from the yeast. But if birds are pooping on it, it's okay. It seems like it's not as much of a concern.
With any techniques, it's really impossible to prevent a dust falling into the yeast. But that is part of the culture. The yeast is so hardy that it will overcompete all the wild yeasts and bacteria.
It's strong enough to survive.
Yeah, and perhaps that is part of why these yeasts are so strong and hardy.
Now, after you've dried the yeast, what do you do with it then? How do you store it after that?
Then you just crack the yeast into smaller flakes. If it's properly dried, then it cracks really easily into smaller flakes. And then you can put it into Ziploc bags, or if you have a vacuum sealer, then you can store it in a vacuum sealed bags, and then you can put it in a freezer. That is the most effective way of storing these yeasts.
Typically it's bad to freeze fresh yeast because the ice crystals, they say, will puncture the cells of the yeast, but if it's dry, there's no water to freeze and form crystals.
Yeah, exactly. Then the water doesn't burst the yeast cells when it is completely dry.
Wow. So now that we've successfully stored our yeast, how do we get it back into life? How do we use it in the next batch?
Usually farmhouse brewers, they make a kind of starter. Well, not exactly a starter. It's more like they just wake up the yeast on the same day, on a brew day.
Mm-hmm.
And most farmhouse brewers just take a small sample of the first wort and cool it to fermentation temperature and then add these quark flakes into this wort sample and then let it wake up before adding to the main batch. But these farmers brewers usually they louter slowly. It takes at least 2 hours or often 3 hours, and this yeast has enough time to wake up. For example, I louter much faster, and I believe many of the listeners also louter much faster. So it's better to make a separate amount of wort to wake up this yeast 2 or 3 hours before pitching. Oh, 2 to 4 hours is a good time.
And again, you know, typically with a typical commercial yeast starter, you know, you want to make it 24 hours in advance, but this this farmhouse yeast, it's ready to go.
Yeah, usually 2 to 4 hours, and then you can see the activity. But it is good to do it perhaps 4 hours before pitching, because then you can really see how the yeast is performing.
Mm.
And that is another advantage of doing a good doing the wake up wort in good time.
Could you detect if this was a bad batch of yeast at that point? Could you at that point smell off aromas or taste off flavors at that point?
If it's a bad yeast, usually what happens, it just doesn't wake up fast enough.
So it just doesn't work.
Yeah, because if there's bacteria, they are usually slower than yeast, and perhaps some farmhouse brewers can detect something, but it is really difficult to detect sourness.
Hmm.
Something like a small, slight sourness from this starter.
Well, I've got an example, a practical, real world example of some batches of beer that I brewed, and I want to kind of use your knowledge here to kind of suss out what was going on. I got a sample of, and it's not a Kvik strain, but it's a Lithuanian farmhouse yeast called Simonitis from a homebrewer named Frederick in Denmark. And he sent me these samples of this Simonitis strain. And it's not clear where he got it from and where the previous person got it from. So we don't know, I don't know how many generations it's removed from the original farmhouse. But I made this this beer, which is basically a raw ale. And I only hopped it. I used 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms of German Pilsner malt, 1 pound or 450 grams of 10 Lovibond Munich. And I mashed that at standard temperature and put 1 ounce or 28 grams of UK Fuggel just in the mash. And then I collected that wort and I raised it to 180 degrees Fahrenheit or 82 C for 15 minutes just to pasteurize it. And then I chilled it down to 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 C. And I pitched this a sample of this yeast in there and left it out on my porch in the summertime, which was, you know, at 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 C. And boy, the yeast was really happy. And after about 24 hours, there was a big croissant on the top. There was a lot of yeast on the top. And so I collected some yeast from that. And then the resulting beer from that first fermentation was nice and kind of tart and sort of lemony and really interesting, kind of a little bit funky, you know, in a farmhouse kind of way. So I was happy with that. So I thought, well, you know, if I can make a tart beer with this yeast, I'll make a Goza. And so I brewed a second beer with the yeast that I top cropped from that first one. This time I used 10 grams of UK Fuggle in the boil and boiled it for 30 minutes and used this repitched yeast. And that beer was not tart. It was not sour. So, Mika, what do you think went on there? Did I not harvest the souring organisms, you know, because of when I harvested in the first place, or did the hops that I use in the boil suppress those souring organisms? What do you think happened?
I think you harvested also some souring bacteria, because the original culture from this Lithuanian brewer Julius Simonaitis, it contains some bacteria, but this lactobacteria can be inhibited by hop bitterness, and it is known that this Julius Simonaitis uses a lot of low alpha hops to in his farmhouse brews, and I think the hop bitterness really makes a difference with this yeast.
So again, that's not following the historical use of the yeast. I didn't do my research well enough in that second batch, and so I got a different result.
Yeah. Well, it's different with many. Whenever you get a new farmhouse yeast, the original brewer can use it in a very different way than other farmhouse brewers. It's kind of difficult to know.
Which doesn't mean that second beer that I brewed was bad. It just wasn't as interesting. It didn't have the characteristics that I was shooting for.
Yeah, and perhaps also pitching rate played a role too.
Ah.
Because it's kind of difficult to estimate how much you are adding yeast when you just harvest top yeast or slurry.
Right.
If you don't weigh the yeast, it's difficult to tell.
Now here's my next question about storage. I still have samples of, you know, the yeast, and also after that first beer was fermented, I did do a bottom collection as well, and I stuck those in the refrigerator, and that was in August of 2018. So this is where I'm a bad yeast daddy. So is there any hope? I mean, should I even try to make a starter from that and see what happens?
Absolutely, you should try it. And I think it has survived, but you definitely need to check that it's very vital and it makes a good beer. You just cannot expect that to make a good beer in the same way as normally yeast normally do.
Right. So I take it that when I make a starter, if I say made a starter out of, you know, dry malt extract, it would be best to leave the hops out of that starter.
I think with this kind of yeast, which is known to contain bacteria, I think it is better to use some hops in a starter.
Huh? Okay. Just very moderate IBUs?
Yeah, something like 10 IBUs is enough.
Okay. Okay. Well, now I have a project. Because my attention, there's so much to brew, Mika. There's so much to brew and so much to brew with, and my attention, it wanders. It way from project to project.
Yeah. Well, me too. I have a difficulty to maintain all those yeast strains because I have something like a dozen farmhouse yeast strains, and I need to think that how to maintain all those yeasts.
Yeah, it's a juggling act.
Yeah, and normally the farmhouse brewers, they just have one yeast and they brew one kind of beer, so it's. They kind of have advantage in that because they know the yeast and know the beer really well.
Sure, sure. Well, Mika, this has been fun. And if people want to know more, they can go to your blog, and there's tons of other material there at Brewing Nordic. And also, we can't forget your book, Viking Age Brew, The Craft of Brewing Sati Farmhouse Ale. So it's been fun getting back together, and I hope we can find an excuse to do it again.
Yeah, I think this farmhouse brewing thing is just exploding, and we are getting new things and new experimentations and new information. So I think next year we will have a lot more to talk about.
Well, excellent. Thanks, Mika.
Thanks.
Well, thanks again to Mika. Once again, the full article is at brewingnordic.com. And be sure to check out Mika's book, Viking Age Brew, The Craft of Brewing Sati Farmhouse Ale. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.